discrimination is something that is needed for the child to create himself as a person. You need to be discriminated from the other. And the other is useful for you, as Freud told, as a model, as an auxiliar, as a rival, as an enemy. There are different kinds of relationship with the other. You need the other, and we are persons connected with the other. Then, if you discriminate you from the other, this is benign. But if you are doing it from a power position, saying, these people are not like me, this is the malignant othering, is malignant because when you are marking these people as different, as the Nazis did with the Jewish people, then it's very easy that these people will become the target for any kind of attack when there will be social problems, economical problems. Then malignant is because you are doing it from a position of power, and because these people that you are discriminating from you, maybe they can become targets for possible attacks for different reasons in the community.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Abel Feinstein. Dr. Feinstein is the chair of the IPA committee entitled Prejudices, Discrimination, and Racism. He and I had planned to have this conversation some time ago, before the recent outbreak of war in the Middle East and the invasion of Israel by Hamas and the slaughter of civilians. And related to that, the upsurge in anti-Semitism around the world. And we begin by his sharing with us the statement that his committee has written about that very issue. From there, we take up the charge, the mandate for his committee, which involves all forms and expressions of racism and discrimination. And it's not just in any particular area of the IPA world. Every area has their own versions of discrimination, their own expressions of it. And the charge of his committee is to address them all. We consider the differentiation between benign otherness and malignant othering. He emphasizes the importance of negation. By that, he means note the temptation in all of us to minimize the malignant power of racism, discrimination, and prejudice, and how we need to be alert because we're all no matter what our background, we're all in danger of being on the receiving end of this. Some of us more at some particular times in history, some others less at particular times in history. We also talk about the future of our field. There's a tension in the title of this podcast, Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch, and it's there for a reason, because there is a tension, because the skills and orientation and the expertise of working on and off the couch are not identical, and they need to both be honored, and they both need to live in tension. And he talks about what he feels is the importance for the future of our field of keeping an eye on the skills and the application of our work off the couch. And he warns us that we should not have the perfect be the enemy of the good. Abel is thoughtful, passionate, and he's a pleasure to listen to. I hope you enjoy this as I did. Abel, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're able to be here. Abel, you are the chair of the Prejudices, Discrimination, and Racism Committee of the IPA. And you and I had planned to have this conversation some time ago. World events being what they are, so much has happened, especially in the world of prejudice, discrimination, and racism. We planned to do this before the Hamas massacre of Israeli civilians and before the upsurge of anti-Semitism around the world. Just before you and I were speaking tonight, I was on the phone with a relative of mine who goes to a well-known college here in the States, and she told me she was afraid to leave her dorm because there are signs all over campus saying, "We will rape and then murder all the Jewish girls on campus." With that as an introduction, your committee, and I'm going to ask you after you read this note to name the members of the committee, you have put together a statement that I'm going to ask you to read, and then we'll go further into the nature of your committee and your plans. But why don't we start with your statement?
Okay. Well, it's nice to see you here and to talk with you here by through the screen, but seeing you and to talk with you. Thank you for the invitation. I will read the statement of our committee. We are publishing it tomorrow, I think. It says, "The rise of antisemitism in the wake of the Hamas barbaric attack. We strongly condemn the murder, maiming, and abduction of hundreds of Israeli civilians and soldiers during an unprovoked attack by Hamas terrorists. The scale of this terrorist attack is unprecedented in recent history. It can only be viewed as a pogrom, and we express our deep solidarity with the victims. Hamas is a terrorist organization, and Palestinians are also their victims. We feel sorrow for all civilians who are killed or suffering in this war, including so many in Gaza. In its founding document, the Hamas Charter, Hamas states that it is committed to waging jihad or holy war in order to raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine. Its stated goal is to eliminate the Jewish state and kill Jews. It must be made clear that the terror against Israel is not motivated by economic, geographic, or political conflicts. All of Israel is considered a holy land that must not be defiled by the presence of infidels, whether Christians or Jews. The statement of freeing Palestine from occupation, from the river to the sea, reveals a clear intent to eliminate the state of Israel. A fight against Hamas is a fight of light against darkness, of liberalism against the forces of oppression. We, as a psychoanalyst, can identify the dehumanization of the Jewish population that was displayed by the horrific massacre on the 7th of October. In addition to the suffering of the Israel's population, anti-Semitic manifestations and attacks have increased exponentially all over the world. As the Prejudice, Discrimination and Racism Committee, we alert to anti-Semitism and the dangerous consequences of its negation. We hope that in due course it will be possible to find strong leaders who will have the courage to meet and negotiate peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Mira Erlich-Ginor, ex officio from the Israel Psychoanalytical Society, Abel Feinstein as chair from the Argentine Psychoanalytical Association, Paula Kleiger from the Michigan Psychoanalytical Society, Rosine Perelberg from the British Psychoanalytical Society, Leonie Sullivan from the Australian Psychoanalytical Society, and Raya Sonana from the Brazilian Society of Psychoanalysis of Sao Paulo.
Thank you. Your mandate for your committee is a large one. And I'd like to read a paragraph which forms the basis of your committee. It says, this is from the IPA, "The Prejudices, Discrimination, and Racism Committee will be a committee of the IPA, which will find a balance between reflection and action regarding malignant othering, including racism and genocide. The aim of the committee is to make recommendations that will address malignant prejudices and discrimination within the IPA and suggest psychoanalytic interventions appropriate for the wider world. The committee's purpose is, first one mentioned, is to develop a set of interventions based on psychoanalytic thinking that address prejudices and discrimination from a psychoanalytic perspective." Abel, this is quite a charge, and it's quite a moment to be carrying this charge. Mm-hmm. You've shared with us the members of the committee who are from all over the IPA world, but you've agreed to chair it. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what has led you to undertake this formidable undertaking?
Sure. I am a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, and I began my psychoanalytic training after working for a couple of years at a psychiatric hospital in Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires, we have a very strong psychoanalytic movement in Argentina, but especially in Buenos Aires, and especially in the area of community, because we have very important pioneers and masters of our movement that they were very active working in the community. And I am talking not now, but in the 50s, no, early in the 40s. Our society was founded in 1942. And many of our members, our pioneers, they work in hospitals. They were strongly connected with the mental health, with the community problems. And for this reason, I think that our training was very strongly influenced by this perspective of psychoanalysis in community and world. Pichon Riviere, one of the founders of our society, was a very important and active member of the work in the community with poor people, with people with different kind of mental diseases. And Arnaldo Raskowski was a pediatrist that he worked in the children's hospital close to my house here in Buenos Aires in the 40s. And he worked with mothers and children at the hospital and so on. There are different other examples. But I want to say that all of us in Argentina have a very strong influence of this contact with the community problems and with the world problems. During the dictatorship here in Argentina, we have a very active group of members. Some of them were unfortunately killed or kidnapped, and they suffered tortures. And this happened also in Uruguay. Our friend Marcelo Viñar, maybe you know him, he's one of the masters of the Uruguayan society. He was exiled in France during the dictatorship. And many of our members were exiled during the dictatorship because they were prosecuted for being not just terrorists. They were only very active working for the community, for poor populations. I think this is the main reason for our interest in these kind of problems.
Let me ask you a question about that, because it's often asked, what does it mean to be an analyst working in the community? And this is the first I'm hearing of the work early in the 40s and 50s, at least in Argentina. I know before the war in Europe, there was such work, but I hadn't heard of it in Argentina. What did that involve? You mentioned a pediatrician working in hospitals. Do you know the nature of the work? Did they write about it? Did they describe what? Because that's sort of what we talk about on this podcast, off the couch. But let's try to flesh it out more than we otherwise do.
Pichon Riviera, as I told you, he worked at the mental health hospital, the main mental health hospital here in Argentina, using psychoanalytic tools, psychoanalytic theories to understand people, basically to listen psychoanalytically to the schizophrenic people or depressed people at the moment when it was a very new discipline in Buenos Aires. Arnaldo Raskowski, he published, I think that in the first issue of our journal, there is a paper, an article by Arnaldo Raskowski about the importance of contact of mother and father, children sleeping with their parents in connection with epilepsy. And the idea was that there was an increase of stimulation of these children, and this became a problem connected with a strong discharge in epilepsy. That to say that they began to use psychoanalytic comprehension and psychoanalytic interventions in order to deal with some kind of disease as epilepsy, schizophrenia, depression, and so on. I think that these are the most important members, but there were many people working at the hospitals. When I did my residency in psychiatry in the 70s, all of our professors, most of our professors, they were people working with poor people in different communities or teaching psychiatry, but like the Menninger in the States or this kind of institutions. And this is the, I would say, the most important influence we received. In addition, I come from a family of Jewish people, immigrants to Argentina, coming from Russia, escaping from the pogroms. And during my childhood, I had a very important influence of my grandfather, the father of my mother. We live with them. They live in our house during all my childhood. And my grandfather was always talking about the pogroms they suffered in Russia, and for this reason they came to Argentina in the end of the 1892, yeah. Before the Russian Revolution. And then he went to the war, fighting for the Russian army. And then after the war, they came to Argentina. Then it was a story that I heard too many times, not so much, but in different opportunities from my grandfather. And it was very impressive, the idea of people escaping from prosecutions, that people came to their shtetls or their little towns and kill all of the people living there, and only a few of them survived, and going from one town to the other, killing people just because they were Jews. Then I went to the Jewish school. I went in the morning to the Spanish school, the official Spanish school, state school. And the afternoon I went to a Jewish school, close to my house at that moment, in Buenos Aires. And there were many, I remember two or three, but there were other teachers of us that they were survivors of the Holocaust, that they came from escaping from Europe, and they were our teachers. And there was also one of them that she was living in Israel, I remember now her, and she came here to teach at our school, just at the beginning of the State of Israel, because it was in 1954, six, 7 years after the Israel was founded. That's to say that I have a personal history connected with Jewish prejudices against Jewish people, the suffering of my families, and the influence of our teachers at that moment, where they came from Europe and they talk with us the risk of, at that moment, all the Arabs countries were against Israel, you remember, you know, sure. At the beginning, yes, of the state. And for us, Nasser was like the personification of evil, Gamal Nasser, no? Gamal, yes, Abdel Nasser. Yes. That to say that I have a very strong influence in connected with Jewish tradition. I'm not a practicing Jew, but I have a very traditional family connected with Jewish traditions. And I know about this kind of issues from my childhood. Then I am more center-left in my ideology. I always was connected with progressive people in my country. And we suffered some kind of discrimination being Jews, but in Argentina we don't have serious problems of discrimination because it's a country where we live with Muslims, with there is a very important Arab community, and we are in friendly relationships. But there were attacks to Jews, for example, during the military government, there was a strong increase of anti-Semitism during those years. Jewish prisoners by the government were more damaged than no Jews people. And this connected with the training that I received is, I think, that the reason why Harriet and our president and vice president offered me the possibility to chair this committee, because I am connected personal and professional to this kind of things, no?
Well described. Yes, thank you for that. One of the points you make in things you've written and things from the IPA is this issue of malignant versus benign othering.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. I think that otherness, that is, the idea is that we are different each from the other, otherness, is one idea that it's convenient to be differentiated from othering. Othering supposes creating the other from a power position. When you are empowered and you discriminate, for example, you create another that is excluded from your interest, is excluded from your community, because you are creating other, but from a position of power. Then, when you talk about benign or malignant othering, I think that it's a way to say that maybe that the discrimination is something that is needed for the child to create himself as a person. You need to be discriminated from the other. And the other is useful for you, as Freud told, as a model, as an auxiliar, as a rival, as an enemy. There are different kinds of relationship with the other. You need the other, and we are persons connected with the other. Then, if you discriminate you from the other, this is benign. But if you are doing it from a power position, saying, these people are not like me, this is the malignant othering, because it's malignant because when you are marking these people as different, as the Nazis did with the Jewish people, then it's very easy that these people will become the target for any kind of attack when there will be social problems, economical problems. Then malignant is because you are doing it from a position of power, and because these people that you are discriminating from you, maybe they can become targets for possible attacks for different reasons in the community.
Yes, it's very helpful. That othering is the malignant sort, and otherness, which all babies feel, and it's part of our nature. The analogy I make is that you root for different sports teams, mm-hmm. and the other team and the other fans are others, and your rivals. You can still admire their team. You could still appreciate a well-played game, but they are still the other. That's the benign sort. It's when you want to murder them, as people do nowadays, that it becomes the malignant sort mm-hmm. of the othering, which is what we're seeing so much of today.
Sorry, Harvey. I would like to clarify with a very common example that is in our yes. patriarchal culture, the males are dealing with women as not from a position of power. The most of the patriarchal culture is used to be imagined from males' minds. Then women are usually discriminated in their works, in their positions in the society. They are not paid so well as males are paid. And discrimination of women is the result of a culture that creates difference, and males are up and women are down. It's still a problem in many countries, in our country, it's one of the problems, that the girls in a house are more affected by economic crisis when they need to abandon the school because the boys of the family are preferred to continue going to the school, and the young girls stay at home caring, for example, for their parents or caring for small siblings. And this creates a difference between male and women, between boys and girls, then between males and women. Women are othered, and in this way, they suffer some kind of discrimination, and we have a very important amount of women killed every year because they are killed by their husbands or are killed by their lovers, because women are seen as a possession of males. And the extreme of this situation is to kill the woman. When you are not the, when she's not your property, when she goes to have another lover, you are in, you have the right of kill her. And I think that all of this idea of male superiority is something that is connected with the idea that you are using your power as a male to punish or even to kill women. And this begins in the childhood. Just to say that this is the malignant othering that we are addressing in our work, that creates so important difference that could be even to kill the other because it's not what you like.
Another point that you make, again, from the position of the committee, is to address what you call negation. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about what you mean by negation.
Sure. I think that we think that negation is one, I would say, our first issue to address in the committee, because to study, there were many groups and many analysts that they studied antisemitism and that they studied any kind of prejudice and discrimination. But we can study it and we can continue contributing to these themes, but we need to alert people that this kind of problems exist even among our communities, even among our colleagues, prejudice, discrimination, and racism, and that we need to be alert that if you negate it, it could damage and could make suffer many people, that there are many people that are suffering if you negate the risk of this prejudice, discrimination, and racism. In addition, I think that in this moment, for example, there are many of our colleagues, Jewish colleagues, that they negate the risk of being Jew, as you told at the beginning of our conversation, they negate the risk of walking in the street or to send their children to the school. And there is a risk. I don't know exactly the amount of risk, but there is an increase of risk. And for example, in Argentina, all the Jewish institutions are more protected now than 1 month ago. The government increased the protection because there were threats to the Jewish community institutions, especially to the schools. That's to say that you cannot negate, for example, antisemitism, because you are in risk, in a possible risk, and the community is in risk if we don't address this as a problem. When you see a first signal of this, you need to be alert and not negate. No, it's not a problem. It will be for a couple of weeks and it will we will surpass this. Maybe if we have, we can hope that this could be resolved, but we need to be alert because negation is, we know as psychoanalysts, that negation is a serious risk even for the life of the patient. If a patient has some kind of disease and prefers to negate it, maybe this could cost his life, their lives. Then I think that our first work in as a committee is to not to alert the community and alert all of us not to negate what is happening. You can think what you want, but don't negate.
Loud and clear. Let me ask you something else. You've written in one of your pieces, I'll quote this, "The future of psychoanalysis is, in my opinion, linked to taking its benefits to larger groups as well as thinking about its contributions to other disciplines and vice versa." That's a powerful statement. The future of psychoanalysis is linked to taking the benefits to larger groups. Now, I and we on this podcast have spent a great deal of time getting to know analysts who have done just that. They've brought their skills to a whole variety of remarkable settings, whether it be hospitals or refugee centers or boardrooms or classrooms, prisons. I mean, we can go on. And there is a great deal to learn from our colleagues who do that work, and there's a great deal of good that reaches the beneficiaries of that work. Tell me what you mean, though, when you say the future of our field depends upon that, because that's a certain twist on it that I'd like to understand.
Thank you for your question. I think that psychoanalysis is a practice that in its traditional sense is connected with a man or a woman or a child going to the analyst 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 days per week and to work with their persons. I think, for example, that in our country, this is very difficult to support today. We are living in a chronic economic crisis, and it's very difficult to support this kind of practice as the only psychoanalytic practice. On the other hand, we have maybe thousands of people with some kind of psychoanalytic training, maybe not at the IPA, but in other groups, that they work in all the hospitals in Buenos Aires. We have psychoanalysts working there. And that means that basically thousands of people that are attended in the hospitals, families, children, different kind of people, they receive some kind of help for their suffering based in psychoanalytic tools. That means a free association, that means respect for singularity, that means to listen what they say and to understand their unconscious meaning of what they are saying. And this implies that they don't use so many drugs because they are contained and they are helped with some kind of psychotherapy basically connected with psychoanalysis. Then, I think that maybe that the traditional psychoanalytical practice in the consulting room could be very difficult in the future, not only for economic reasons, because I think that our culture today is not very friendly with long time of treatments to think about what is happening for you, to you. And there is a culture of something quickly and effective. And it's very difficult to use psychoanalysis stricto sensu in this way when the culture is asking for something quickly. Then, for economic reasons or for cultural reasons, I think that maybe that in a future, maybe 50 years now, it will be difficult to have a couch as I have and you have, and have patients every day, 8 or 10 patients. But I am sure that this kind of help that we are offering using psychoanalysis will be very helpful for so many people. We live in a city where 25% more or less of the people receive some kind of psychotherapy in their lives. 25-30%. And we talk about this as we talk about this openly. Everyone you talk in Buenos Aires is proud to say that he goes to an analyst. Then I think that people will request psychoanalytic help in the future. We only need to address some kind of psychoanalysis that could be helpful for all of this amount of people. That needs a good training, because to do this kind of work, you need to be trained in a good way by the IPA, or not by the IPA, but in a good way. And in this way, you are using psychoanalysis in mental health as a very, very important tool. I know that this is not happening in other countries. For example, in the States, what I know is not so frequent that psychoanalytic treatments are so common in different public hospitals and so on. This is in the field of health, but also in the field of education. Most of our schools have psychologists, and most of them are psychoanalysts, helping to understand what is happening with the children at schools. And we have our different medicine training or humanities, training in humanities. All of them, they have some kind of psychoanalytic tools or psychoanalytic theories including in their training. That's to say that when I wrote the statement that you read, I think that this will be surely the future of psychoanalysis. I am not so sure that the iconic psychoanalytic, we say Woody Allen psychoanalysis, you know, it's the... the caricature of psychoanalysis. I don't know if this could be supported, but all of the other, yes.
Let me push back a little bit just to create a point of conversation. It seems to me that psychoanalysis of the traditional sort requires something special of the analyst. And it requires many things. But the one I want to focus on that I think uniquely defines the psychoanalytic encounter is that we are asked by patients unknowingly to accept how they see us. And they will relate to us unknowingly through the prism of their past, and will relate to us with conviction that we are this person that they are imagining us to be. And our task is to accept it. Now, at times, it's fairly easy to accept because it's sort of close to how we would like to view ourselves. And at times, it's very difficult to accept because it's dark and malignant from their past that they see us as. And we need to tolerate that, and we all do it imperfectly. Mm-hmm. And we need to tolerate it for the benefit of understanding where it's coming from in the patient and help them to see their history and their disavowed present state of mind. That's a very challenging thing to do. It takes one's own analysis and many years of training.
Mm-hmm.
My concern, this podcast is called On and Off the Couch, so I want to honor the tension in the two. My concern is that if we lean too far in the off the couch, that we run the risk of losing that very special skill that only comes from hard work and training on the couch. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you. I initially agree with you that we need to have our own analysis, our profound, and as much as more profound as possible analysis to deal with this kind of transferences. And sometimes it's not easy. But it's difficult with my English to say that, but there is a thought that says more or less that the best is enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm,
no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
Well, I would like to say to you that the ideal is what you say, and we try to do it with our candidates, and I think that all of us, we have, good enough analysis to practice psychoanalysis. But all of these other people that are working thousands and thousands, it's not mm-hmm. just hundreds, thousands of people, that they have some kind of psychoanalytic-based therapist, they are more prepared to deal with this kind of transferences, this kind of problems that you mentioned, that people that don't have any kind of connection with dealing with their own unconscious. Then I would say I would like to have the best possible psychoanalytic treatment for all the colleagues that are working with patients in our field. That means what the IPA is requesting. The idea is to have the best possible treatments for this kind of, for our colleagues. My concern is that if we are in Buenos Aires, we have now 20 candidates, and we are 2,000 people in Buenos Aires from the IPA in a city of 10 million people. I don't know exactly how many we are, Buenos Aires and the surroundings. We can attend only a small proportion of our communities and of our citizens. And there is an enormous request of help, of suffering of many people. Then, I would prefer to reserve these 2,000 people, not all of them, but most of them, for training psychotherapists, and to have all of this enormous amount of colleagues working with psychoanalysis in some way to deal surely best as to use any kind of other treatments. Then I agree with you, but I think that we need to extend the area of our influence if we want to psychoanalysis to survive in 50 years. Because if not, it will be only a treatment for extreme minority of people, and people will don't have any other offer to their suffering as to go to the psychiatrist and use drugs.
Yeah,
we prefer to have not so exquisite treatments for all the people, but to offer them some kind of psychoanalytic help that is, I think it's my conviction that it's the best tool to deal with human suffering.
Abel, you said it beautifully. Thank you for that.
Sorry for my Spanglish.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was perfectly clear. And the only thing clearer than your English was your heart. And I thank you for that. Again, you're the chair of the Prejudices, Discrimination, and Racism Committee. I've enjoyed getting to know your work. Thank you for spending time, and thank you for sharing with us your vision for the present and also for the future of our field. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you very much. For me and on behalf of my friends of the committee, we are very grateful for your help, for your hospitality.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.